Chapter 41. Crozier. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. 25 April, 1848.
O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?
Lieutenant Irving had been Crozier's officer, but Captain Fitzjames had a better voice. The lisp had all but disappeared, and a better way with scripture, so Crozier was grateful that he was doing a majority of the burial service reading. All of the men in Terror Camp had turned out, except those on watch, those in sick bay, or those performing essential services such as Lloyd in sick bay, and Mr. Diggle and Mr. Wall, and their mates labouring over the four whaleboat stoves, cooking up some of the Eskimos' fish and seal meat for dinner. At least 80 men were at this graveside, about 100 yards from camp, standing like dark wraiths in the still swirling fog.
The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as ye know that your labour is not in vain in the Lord.
The other surviving officers and two mates were to carry Irving to the grave. There was not enough wood at Terror Camp to make a coffin, but Mr. Honey the carpenter had found enough wood to knock together a door-sized pallet on which Irving's body, now securely sewn into canvas, could be transported on, and upon which the body could be lowered into the grave. Although the ropes were to be set across the grave in proper naval fashion, as they would be for any land burial, there would not be much lowering to do. Hickey and his men had been unable to dig deeper than 3 feet. The ground below that level was as hard frozen as solid stone. So the men had gathered scores of large stones to lay over the body before piling on the frozen topsoil and gravel, then more stones to lay over that. No one had real hopes that it would keep the white bears or the other summer predators out, but the labour was a sign of most of the men's affection for John Irving. Most of the men. Crozier glanced over at Hickey, standing next to Magnus Manson and the Erebus gunroom steward who had been flogged after Carnival, Richard Aylmore. There was a cluster of other malcontents around these men, several of the Terror seamen who had been eager to kill Lady Silence, even if it took a mutiny to do so back in January. But like all the others standing around the pathetic hole in the ground, they had their Welsh wigs and caps off, and their comforters pulled up to their noses and ears. Crozier's middle-of-the-night interrogation of Cornelius Hickey in the captain's command tent had been tense and terse.
"Good morning to you, Captain. Would you like me to tell you what I told Captain Fitzjames and..."
"Take off your slops, Mr. Hickey."
"Pardon me, sir."
"You heard me."
"Aye, sir. But if you want to hear how it was when I saw the savages murdering poor Mr. Irving."
"It's Lieutenant Irving, Calker's mate. I heard your story from Captain Fitzjames. Do you have anything to add or retract from it? Anything to amend?"
No, sir."
"Take those outer slops off. Mittens, too."
"Aye, sir. There, sir, how's that? Shall I just set them over on the..."
"Drop them on the floor. Jacket's off, too."
"My jacket, sir? It's bloody cold in here." "Yes, sir."
"Mr. Hickey, why did you volunteer to go search for Lieutenant Irving when he hadn't yet been gone much more than an hour? No one else was worried about him."
"Oh, I don't think I volunteered it, Captain. My recollection is that Mr. Farr asked me to go look for..."
"Mr. Farr reported that you asked several times if Lieutenant Irving wasn't overdue and volunteered to go find him on your own while the others rested after their meal. Why did you do that, Mr. Hickey?"
"If Mr. Farr says that, well, we must have been worried about him, Captain. The Lieutenant, I mean."
"Why?"
"May I put my jackets and slops back on, Captain? It's bloody freezing in..."
"No. Take off your waistcoat and sweaters. Why were you worried about Lieutenant Irving?"
"If you're concerned, that is, thinking I was wounded today, Captain, I wasn't. The savages never saw me. No wounds on me, sir, I assure you."
"Take that sweater off as well. Why were you worried about Lieutenant Irving?"
"Well, the lads and me, you know, Captain.
No.
We was just concerned, you know, that one of our party was missing, like. Also, sir, I was cold, sir. We'd been sitting around to eat what little cold food we had. I thought that walking, following the lieutenant's tracks to make sure he was all right, would warm me up, sir.
Show me your hands.
Pardon me, Captain.
Your hands?
Aye, sir. Pardon my shaking, sir. I ain't been warm all day, and with all me layers off, but this shirt and...
Turn them over. Palms up.
Aye, sir.
Is that blood under your nails, Mr. Heckey?
Could be, Captain. You know how it is.
No. Tell me.
Well, we ain't had real water what to bath ourselves in for months, sir. And what with the scurvy and dysentery-like, there's a certain amount of bleeding when we see to the necessaries.
Are you saying that a Royal Navy petty officer on my ship wipes his arse with his fingers, Mr. Hickey?
No, sir. I mean, may I put my layers back on now, Captain? You can see I ain't wounded or anything. This cold is enough to shrink a man's...
Take your shirts and undershirts off.
Are you serious, sir?
Don't make me ask a second time, Mr. Hickey. We don't have a brig. Any men I send to the brig will spend time chained to one of the whaleboats.
Here, sir. How's this? Just me flesh, freezing as it is. If my poor missus could see me now.
It didn't say on your muster papers that you were married, Mr. Hickey.
Oh, my Louise has been dead going on 7 years now, Captain. Of the pox. God rest her soul.
Why did you tell some of the other men before the mast that when it came time to kill officers, Lieutenant Irving should be the first?
I never said no such thing, sir.
I have reports of you saying that, and other mutinous statements, going back to before the carnival on the ice, Mr. Hickey. Why did you single out Lieutenant Irving? What had that officer ever done to you?
Why, nothing, sir. And I never said no such thing. Bring in the man who said I did, and I'll dispute it to his face and spit in his eye.
What had Lieutenant Irving ever done to you, Mr. Hickey? Why did you tell the other men from both Erebus and Terror that Irving was a whoremaster and a liar?
I swear to you, Captain. Pardon my teeth chattering, Captain, but Jesus Christ, the night is cold against the bearskin. I swear to you, I didn't say no such thing. A lot of us looked on poor Lieutenant Irving sort of like a son, Captain. A son. It was only my worry for him out there today that made me go check on him. Good thing I did too, sir, or we would have never caught the murdering bastards who...
Put your layers on, Mr. Hickey.
Aye, sir.
No, do it outside. Get out of my sight.
Man that is born of a woman hath but a short time to live, and is full of misery,
intoned FitzJames.
He cometh up and is cut down like a flower. He fleeth as it were a shadow, and never continueth in one stay.
Hodgson and the other pallbearers were using great care in lowering the pallet with Irving's canvas-wrapped body to the ropes held in place above the shallow hole by some of the healthier seamen. Crozier knew that Hodgson and Irving's other friends had gone into the post-mortem tent one at a time to pay their respects before the lieutenant had been sewn into his sail shroud by old Murray. The visitors had set several tokens of their affection next to the lieutenant's body. The recovered brass telescope, its lenses shattered in the shooting that the boy had so esteemed. A gold medal with his name engraved on it that he had won in competitions on the gunnery ship HMS Excellent. And at least 1 5-pound note, as if some old wager had been paid at last. For some reason, optimism, youthful naivete, Irving had packed his dress uniform in his small bag of personal belongings, and he was being buried in it now. Crozier wondered idly if the gilt buttons on the uniform, each bearing the image of an anchor surrounded by a crown, would be there when nothing else but the boy's bleached bones and the gold gunnery medal survived the long process of decay.
In the midst of life, we are in death,
FitzJames recited from memory, his voice sounding tired but properly resonant.
Of whom may we seek for succour, but of thee, O Lord, who for our sin art justly displeased?
Captain Crozier knew that there was one other item sewn into the sail shroud with Irving, one that no one else knew about. It lay under his head like a pillow. It was a gold, green, red, and blue silk oriental handkerchief, and Crozier had surprised the giver by coming into the post-mortem tent after good sir, Lloyd, Hodgson, and the others had departed, just before old Murray the sailmaker was to enter and sew up the shroud he had prepared, and upon which Irving already lay in state. Lady Silence had been there, bending over the corpse, setting something beneath Irving's head. Crozier's first impulse had been to reach for his pistol in his greatcoat pocket, but he'd frozen in place as he saw the Eskimo girl's eyes and face. If there were no tears in those dark, hardly human eyes, there was something else luminous there, with some emotion he could not identify. Grief? The captain did not think so. It was more some kind of complicit recognition at seeing Crozier. The captain felt the same strange stirring in his head that he had so often felt around his memo Moira. But the girl obviously had set the oriental handkerchief carefully in place under the dead boy's head as some sort of gesture. Crozier knew the handkerchief had been Irving's. He'd seen it on special occasions as far back as the day they'd sailed in May of 1845. Had the Eskimo wench stolen it? Plundered it from his dead body just yesterday? Silence had followed Irving's sledge party from Terra to Terra Camp more than a week ago, and then had just disappeared, never joining the men in the camp. Almost everyone, excluding Crozier, who still held hopes she might lead them to food, had considered this good riddance. But all during this terrible morning, part of Crozier had wondered if somehow Silence had been responsible for his officer's murder out there on the windswept gravel ridge. Had she led her Eskimo hunter friends back here to raid the camp and run into Irving on the way, first giving a fate to the starving man with meat, and then murdering him in cold blood to keep him from telling the others here of his encounter? Had Silence been the possibly a young woman that Farr and Hodgson and the others had caught a glimpse of, fleeing with an Eskimo man with a headband? She could have changed her parka if she had returned to her village in the past week. And who could tell young Eskimo wenches apart at a glance? Crozier considered all of these things, but now, in a time-stopped moment, both he and the young woman were startled into immobility for long seconds. The captain looked into her face and knew, whether in his heart or in what Memo Moira insisted was his second sight, that she wept inside for John Irving and was returning a gift of the silk handkerchief to the dead man. Crozier guessed that the handkerchief had been presented to her during the February visit to the Eskimos' snow house that Irving had dutifully reported to the captain, but had reported with few details. Now Crozier wondered if the two had been lovers. And then Lady Silence was gone. She'd slipped under the tent flap and was gone without a sound. When Crozier later queried the men in the camp and those on guard if they had seen anything, none had. At that moment in the tent, the captain had gone over to Irving's body, looked down at the pale, dead face, made even whiter with the small pillow of the brightly covered handkerchief behind it, and then he had pulled the canvas over the lieutenant's face and body, shouting for old Murray to come in and do the sewing. "Yet, O Lord God most holy, O Lord most mighty, O holy and most merciful Saviour," Fitzjames was saying, "deliver us not into the bitter pains of eternal death. Thou knowest, Lord, the secrets of our hearts. Shut not thy merciful ears to our prayer, but spare us, Lord, most holy, O God most mighty, O holy and merciful Saviour, thou most worthy Judge eternal, suffer us not at our last hour for any pains of death to fall from thee." Fitzjames's voice fell silent. He stepped back from the grave. Crozier, lost in reverie, stood for a long moment until a shuffling of feet made him realize that his part of the service had arrived. He walked to the head of the grave.
"We therefore commit the body of our friend and officer, John Irving, to the deep," he rasped,
also reciting from memory that remained all too clear from many repetitions despite the pall of fatigue in his mind.
to be turned into corruption, looking for the resurrection of the body, when the sea and the earth shall give up their dead.
The body was lowered the 3 feet, and Crozier tossed a handful of frozen soil onto it. The gravel made a strangely moving, rasping sound as it landed on the canvas above Irving's face and slid to the sides.
"And the life of the world to come, through our Lord Jesus Christ, who at his coming shall change our vile body, that it may be like his glorious body, according to the mighty working, whereby he is able to subdue all things to himself."
The service was over. The ropes had been retrieved. Men stamped cold feet, tugged on their Welsh wigs and caps, rewrapped their comforters, and filed back through the fog to Terra Camp for their hot dinner. Hodgson, Little, Thomas, DeVoe, LeVeconte, Blanky, Pegler, and a few of the other officers stayed behind, dismissing the seaman's detail that had been waiting to bury the body. The officers shoveled soil and began setting in the first layer of stones together. They wanted Irving buried as best he could be under the circumstances. When they finished, Crozier and Fitzjames walked away from the others. They would eat their dinners much later, for now they planned to walk the 2 miles up to Victory Point, where Graham Gore had left his brass canister and optimistic message in James Ross's old cairn almost a year ago. Crozier planned to leave word there today on what the fate of their expedition had been in the past 10.5 months since Gore's note had been written, and on what they planned to do next. Plodding tiredly through the fog, hearing one of the ship's bells ringing for dinner somewhere in the roiling fog behind them, they had, of course, brought both Terra's and Erebus's bells along in the whaleboats dragged across the frozen sea to camp when the ships were abandoned. Francis Crozier hoped to Christ that he would decide on their course of action by the time that he and Fitzjames reached the cairn. If he could not, he thought, he was afraid he might start weeping. Chapter 42. Pegler. Latitude 69 degrees 37 minutes 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees 41 minutes west. 25 April 1848. There hadn't been enough fish and seal on the sled to serve it as a main dish to 95 or 100 men. A few were too ill to eat anything solid, and even Mr. Diggle's and Mr. Wall's record at routinely performing loaves and fishes miracles with the limited ship's stores did not allow them to fully succeed at this one, especially since some of the food on the Eskimo sledge had been particularly putrid. But every man managed to get a taste of the savoury blubber or fish, along with the prepared goldener soups or stews or vegetables. Harry Pegler enjoyed the meal, even though he was shaking with cold as he ate it, and knew that it would only provoke the diarrhea that was already ripping him apart every day. After the meal, and before beginning their scheduled duties, Pegler and steward John Bridgins walked together with their tin mugs of tepid tea. The fog muffled their own voices, even as it seemed to amplify sounds from far away. They could hear men arguing over a card game in one of the tents on the far side of Terra Camp. From the northwest, the direction the two captains had walked before dinner, came the artillery rumble of thunder out over the pack ice. That sound had been going on all day, but no storm had arrived. The two paused at the long line of boats and boat sledges drawn up above the tumble of ice that would be the inlet's shoreline if there ever came a thaw to the sea.
"Tell me, Harry," said Bridgins, "which of these boats will we be taking if or when we must go to the ice again?"
Pegler sipped his tea and pointed.
"I'm not certain, but I think Captain Crozier has decided to take 10 of the 18 here. We don't have men well enough to haul more these days."
"Then why did we man-haul all 18 to Terra Camp?"
"Captain Crozier considered the possibility that we'd stay at Terra Camp for another 2 or 3 months, perhaps letting the ice around this point melt. We would have been better off with more boats, keeping some in reserve should others be damaged. And we could have hauled much more in the way of food, tents, and supplies in 18 boats. With more than 10 men in each boat now, it'll be damned crowded, and we'll have to leave too much of the stores behind."
"But do you think we'll leave for the south with only 10 boats, Harry?" and soon.
I hope to Christ we do, said Pegler.
He told Bridgens about what he had seen that morning, what good sir had said about the Eskimos' stomachs being as full of seal meat as Irving's had been, and how the captain had treated those present, perhaps excepting the Marines, as a potential board of inquiry. He added that the captain had sworn them to secrecy.
I think, John Bridgens said softly, that Captain Crozier is not convinced that the Eskimo killed Lieutenant Irving.
What? Who else could?
Pegler stopped. The cold and nausea that were always with him now seemed to surge up and through him. He had to lean against a whaleboat to keep his knees from buckling. He had never considered for an instant that anyone other than the savages could have done what they'd done to John Irving. He thought of the frozen pile of grey entrails on the ridgeline.
Richard Aylmore is saying that the officers have led us into this mess, said Bridgens, in a voice so low it was almost a whisper. He's telling everyone who won't inform on him that we should kill the officers and parcel out the extra food rations amongst the men. Aylmore in our group, and that Corker's mate in yours, say we should go back to Terror at once.
Back to Terror?
Repeated Pegler. He knew that his mind was dull with illness and exhaustion these days, but the idea made no sense at all. The ship was locked in the ice far out there, and would be for months more, even if Summer did condescend to appear this year.
Why don't I hear these things, John? I've heard none of this seditious whispering.
Bridgens smiled.
They don't trust you not to tell, my dear Harry.
But they trust you?
Of course not. But I hear everything sooner or later. Stewards are invisible, you know, being neither fish nor fowl, nor good red meat. Speaking of which, that was a delightful meal, wasn't it? Perhaps the last relatively fresh food we shall ever eat.
Pegler didn't answer. His mind was racing.
What can we do to warn Fitzjames and Crozier?
Oh, they have this information about Aylmore and Hickey, and the others,
the old steward said nonchalantly.
Our captains have their own sources before the mast and around the scuttlebutts.
The scuttlebutts have been frozen solid for months, said Pegler.
Bridgens chuckled.
That seems to be a very good metaphor, Harry, and all the more ironic for its literalness, or at least an amusing euphemism.
Pegler shook his head. He still felt the nausea from the idea that amidst all this illness and terror, any man among them would turn on another.
Tell me, Harry, said Bridgens,
patting the inverted hull of the first whaleboat with his worn mitten.
Which of these boats might we be hauling with us, and which will be left behind?
The four whaleboats will go for shore,
Pegler said absently, still mulling over this talk of mutiny and what he had seen that morning.
The jolly boats are as long as the whaleboats, but damned heavy. If I were the captain, I might leave them behind and take the four cutters instead. They're only 25 feet long, but much lighter than whaleboats. But their draft may be too much for the Great Fish River, if we can get there. The ship's smaller boats and dinghies are too light for the open sea, and too flimsy for much hauling and river work.
So it's the four whaleboats, four cutters, and two pinnaces, you think?
Asked Bridgens.
Yes,
said Pegler, and had to smile. For all his years at sea and all his thousands of volumes read, Subordinate Officer's Steward John Bridgens still knew very little about some things nautical.
I think those 10, yes, John.
But best, said Bridgens, if most of the sick recover, that leaves only 10 of us to manhaul each boat. Can we do that, Harry?
Pegler shook his head again.
It won't be like the sea ice crossing from Terror, John.
Well, thank the dear Lord for that small blessing.
No, I mean that we'll almost certainly be man-hauling these boats over land rather than sea ice. It'll be much harder than the crossing from Terror, where we man-hauled only 2 boats at a time and could put as many men on a team as we needed to get over the rough parts. And the boats now will be even more heavily laden with stores and are sick than before. I suspect that we'll have 20 or more in harness for each boat hauled. Even then, we'll have to haul the 10 boats in relays.
Relays? Said Bridgens. Dear heavens, it will take us forever to move even 10 boats if we're constantly going back and forth. And the weaker and sicker we become, the slower we will go.
Yes, said Pegler.
Is there any chance that we shall get these boats all the way to the Great Fish River? and then up the river to Great Slave Lake and the outpost there?
I doubt it, said Pegler. Perhaps if a few of us survive long enough to get the boats to the mouth of the river, and the right boats make it, and they're rigged just perfectly for river running, and... But no, I doubt if there's any real chance.
Then why on earth would Captains Crozier and Fitzjames put us through such labour and misery if there is no chance? Asked Bridgens.
The older man's voice did not sound aggrieved or anxious or desperate, merely curious. Pegler had heard John pose 1,000 questions about astronomy, natural history, geology, botany, philosophy, and a score of other subjects in precisely that same soft, mildly curious tone. With most of the other questions, it had been the teacher who knew the answer, quizzing his student in a polite way. Here, Pegler was sure that John Bridgens did not know the answer to this question.
What's the alternative? Asked the foretop captain.
We could stay here at Terra Camp, said Bridgens. Or even return to Terra once our numbers have decreased.
To do what? Demanded Pegler. Just to wait to die?
To wait in comfort, Harry.
To die,
said Pegler, realizing that he was almost shouting.
Who the fuck wants to wait in comfort to die? At least if we get the boats to the coast, any of the boats, some of us may have a chance. There might be open water east to Boothia. We may be able to force passage up the river. At least some of us. And those who make it will at least be able to tell the rest of our loved ones what happened to us, where we were buried, and what we were thinking of them in the end.
You are my loved one, Harry, said Bridgens. The only man or woman or child left in the world who cares whether I am alive or dead, much less what I may have thought before I fell or where my bones will lie.
Pegler, still angry, felt his heart pounding inside his chest. You're going to outlive me, John.
Oh, at my age, and with my infirmities and proclivities towards illness, I hardly think.
You're going to outlive me, John, grated Pegler.
He shocked himself by the intensity of his voice, and Bridgens blinked and fell silent. Pegler took the older man's wrist.
Promise me you'll do one thing for me, John.
Of course.
There was none of the usual banter or irony in Bridgens' voice.
My diary. It's not much. I have trouble even thinking, much less writing these days. I'm quite sick with this goddamn scurvy, John, and it seems to addle my brain. But I've kept the diary for the past 3 years. My thoughts are in it. All of the events we've experienced are put down there. If you could take it when I leave you, just take it back with you to England. I'd appreciate it.
Bridgens only nodded.
John,
said Harry Pegler,
I think Captain Crozier is going to decide to take us on the march soon. Very soon. He knows that every day we wait here, we get weaker. Soon we won't be able to haul boats at all. We'll begin dying by the dozens here at Terra Camp before long, and it won't take that thing on the ice to carry us away, or kill us in our beds.
Bridgens nodded again.
He was looking down at his mittened hands.
We're not on the same man-hauling teams. Won't share the same boats, and may not even end up together if the captains decide to try for different escape routes, continued Pegler.
I want to say goodbye today and never have to do it again.
Bridgens nodded mutely. He was looking at his boots. The fog rolled over the boats and sledges and moved around them like some alien god's cold breath. Pegler hugged him. Bridgens stood upright and brittle for a moment and then returned the hug. Both men clumsy in their many layers and frozen slops. The captain of the foretop turned then and walked slowly back toward Terra Camp and his tiny circular Holland tent with its group of off-duty shivering, unwashed men huddling together in inadequate sleeping bags. When he paused and looked back toward the line of boats, there was no sign of Bridgens at all. It was as if the fog had swallowed him without a trace.
Chapter 43. Crozier. Latitude 69 degrees, 37 minutes, 42 seconds north. Longitude 98 degrees, 41 minutes west. 25 April, 1848. He fell asleep while walking. Crozier had been talking to Fitzjames about arguments for and against letting the men spend more days at Terra Camp as the two walked the 2 miles north
through the fog to James Ross's cairn, when suddenly Fitzjames was shaking him awake.
"We're here, Francis. This is the large white boulder near the shore ice. Victory Point and the cairn must be to our left. Were you really sleeping while walking?"
"No, of course not," rasped Crozier.
"Then what did you mean when you said, 'Watch out for the open boat with the two skeletons, and watch out for the girls and the table wrappings'? It made no sense. We were discussing whether Dr. Goodsir should stay behind a terror camp with the seriously ill men, while the stronger ones try for Great Slave Lake with just four boats."
"Just thinking aloud," muttered Crozier.
"Who is Memo Moira?" asked Fitzjames. "And why should she not send you to communion?"
Crozier pulled his cap and wool scarves off, letting the fog and cold air slap his face as he walked up the slow rise.
"Where the hell is the cairn?" he snapped.
"I don't know," said Fitzjames. "It should be right here. Even on a sunny, clear day, I walk this inlet coastline to the white boulder near the bergs, and then left up to the cairn at Victory Point."
"We can't have walked past it," said Crozier. "We'd be out on the fucking pack ice."
It took them almost 45 minutes to find the cairn in the fog. At one point when Crozier said,
"The goddamned white thing from the ice has taken it and hidden it somewhere to confound us,"
Fitzjames had only looked at his commanding officer and said nothing. Finally, feeling their way along together like two blind men, not risking separating in the roiling fog, sure that they wouldn't even hear the other's calls over the constant drumbeat of approaching thunder, they literally stumbled into the cairn.
"This isn't where it was," croaked Crozier.
"It doesn't seem to be," agreed the other captain.
"Ross's cairn with Gore's note in it was at the top of the rise at the end of Victory Point. This must be 100 yards to the west of there, almost down in this valley."
"It is very odd," said Fitzjames. "Francis, you've come to the Arctic so many times. Is this thunder and the lightning, if it comes, so common up here so early?"
"I've never seen or heard either before midsummer," rasped Crozier. "And never like this. It sounds like something worse."
"What could be worse than a thunderstorm in late April with the temperature still below zero?"
"Cannon fire," said Crozier.
"Cannon fire?"
"From the rescue ship. It came down open leads all the way from Lancaster Strait and through Peel Sound, only to find Erebus crushed and Terror abandoned. They're firing their guns for 24 hours to get our attention before sailing away."
"Please, Francis, stop," said Fitzjames. "If you continue, I may vomit, and I've already done my vomiting for today."
"Sorry," said Crozier, fumbling in his pockets.
"Is there really any chance that it's guns firing for us?"
asked the younger captain.
"It sounds like guns."
"Not a snowball's chance in Sir John Franklin's hell," said Crozier. "That pack ice is solid all the way to Greenland."
"Then where is the fog coming from?"
asked Fitzjames, his voice more idly curious than plaintive.
"Are you searching your pockets for something in particular, Captain Crozier?"
"I forgot to bring the brass messenger canister we brought from Terror for this note," Crozier admitted. "I felt the lump in my slop's pocket during the burial service and thought I had it, but it's only my god-besotted pistol."
"Did you bring paper?"
"No. Jobson had some ready, but I left it in the tent."
"Did you bring a pen? Ink? I find that if I do not carry the ink pot in a pouch close to my skin, it freezes very quickly."
"No pen or ink," admitted Crozier.
"It's all right," said Fitzjames. "I have both in my waistcoat pocket. We can use Graham Gore's note. Write on it."
"If this is the same damned cairn,"
muttered Crozier.
"Ross's cairn was 6 feet tall. This thing hardly comes up to my chest."
Both men fumbled to remove rocks from a part of the cairn far down on the leeward side. They did not want to have to dismantle the entire thing and then have to rebuild it. Fitzjames reached into the dark hole, fumbled around a second, and withdrew a brass cylinder, tarnished, but still intact.
"Well, I'll be damned, and dressed in cheap motley," said Crozier. "Is it Graham's?"
"It has to be,"
said Fitzjames, tugging his mitten off with his teeth. He clumsily unfurled the parchment note and began to read. 28th of May, 1847.
HM ships Erebus and Terror wintered in the ice in latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north, longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. After having wintered in 1846-7 at Beachy Island in latitude 74 degrees 43 minutes 28 seconds north, long...
Fitzjames interrupted himself.
Wait, that's incorrect. We spent the winter of 1845-46 at Beachy, not the winter of 46-47.
Sir John dictated this to Graham Gore before Gore left the ships,
rasped Crozier.
Sir John must have been as tired and confused then as we are now.
No one has ever been as tired and confused as we are now, said Fitzjames. Here, later it goes on. Sir John Franklin commanding the expedition. All well?
Crozier did not laugh or weep. He said,
Graham Gore deposited the note here just a week before Sir John was killed by the thing on the ice.
And one day before Graham himself was killed by the thing on the ice, said Fitzjames. All well. That seems like another lifetime, does it not, Francis? Can you remember a time when any of us could write such a thing with an easy conscience? There's blank space around the edge of the message if you want to write there.
The two huddled on the lee side of the stone cairn. The temperature had dropped and the wind had come up, but the fog continued to swirl around them as if unaffected by mere wind or temperature. It was beginning to get dark. To the northwest, the sound of guns rumbled on. Crozier breathed on the tiny portable ink pot to warm the ink, dipped the pen through the scrim of ice, rubbed the nib against his frozen sleeve, and began writing.
25th April. HM's ships Terror and Erebus were deserted on the 22nd April, 5 leagues north-northwest of this, having been beset since 12th September 1846. The officers and crews, consisting of 105 souls, under the command of Captain F.R.M. Crozier, landed here in latitude 69 degrees 37 minutes 42 seconds, longitude 98 degrees 41 minutes. This paper was found by Lieutenant Irving under the cairn supposed to have been built by Sir James Ross in 1831, 4 miles to the northward, where it had been deposited by the late Commander Gore in June 1847. Sir James Ross's pillar has not, however, been found, and the paper has been transferred to this position, which is that in which Sir J. Ross's pillar was erected.
Crozier stopped writing.
What the hell am I saying? He thought.
He squinted to reread the last few sentences.
Under the cairn supposed to have been built by Sir James Ross in 1831, Sir James Ross's pillar has not, however, been found.
Crozier let out a tired sigh. John Irving's first order upon ferrying the first load of materiel from Erebus and Terra long ago last August to begin the stockpile that would become Terra Camp was to find Victory Point and Ross's cairn again, then set up the cache for Terra Camp a few miles south of it, along a more sheltered inlet. Irving had marked the cairn on their earliest crudely drawn maps as 4 miles from the cache point rather than the actual 2 miles, but they'd quickly discovered their mistake during subsequent man-haulings. In Crozier's fatigue now, his mind kept insisting that the canister with Gore's message had been moved from some false James Ross cairn to this real James Ross cairn. Crozier shook his head and looked at Fitzjames, but the other captain was resting his arms on his raised knees and his head on his arms. He was snoring softly. Crozier held the sheet of paper, pen, and tiny inkpot in one hand, and scooped up snow with his other mittened hand, rubbing some on his face. The shock of the cold made him blink.
Concentrate, Francis. For the sake of Christ, concentrate.
He wished he had another sheet of paper so that he could start over. Squinting at the cramped scrawl moving around the margins of the paper, words crawling like tiny ants, the center of the paper already filled with the official typeset information stating officiously,
Whoever finds this paper is requested to forward it to the Secretary of the Admiralty.
Then several more paragraphs repeating the instruction in French, German, Portuguese, and other languages. Then with Gore's scrawl above that, Crozier did not recognize his own handwriting. The script was palsied, cramped, tenuous, obviously the hand of a terrified or freezing or dying man, or of all three. It doesn't matter, he thought. Either no one is ever going to read this, or they will read it long after we are all dead. It doesn't matter at all. Perhaps Sir John always understood this. Perhaps this is why he left none of the brass message canisters behind on Beachy. He knew all along.
He dipped the pen in the rapidly freezing ink and wrote again.
Sir John Franklin died on 11th of June 1847, and the total loss by deaths on the expedition has been to this date 9 officers and 15 men.
Crozier stopped again. Was that correct? Had he included John Irving in the total? He couldn't do the arithmetic. There had been 105 souls under his care yesterday. 105 when he had left Terra, his ship, his home, his wife, his life. He would leave the number. Upside down, at the top of the sheet, on the bit of white space left, he scrawled F.R.M. Crozier, and after it wrote Captain and Senior Officer. He nudged FitzJames awake.
James, sign your name here.
The other captain rubbed his eyes, peered at the paper but did not seem to take the time to read it, and signed his name where Crozier pointed.
Add Captain HMS Erebus, said Crozier.
FitzJames did so. Crozier folded the paper, slid it back into the brass canister, sealed it, and set the cylinder back in the cairn. He pulled his mitten on and fumbled the stones back into place.
Francis, did you tell them where we are headed and when we're leaving?
Crozier realized he had not. He started to explain why it seemed to be a sentence of death for the men whether they stayed or went. Why he had not decided yet between man-hauling for distant Boothia or toward George Back's fabled but terrible Great Fish River. He started to explain to FitzJames how they were fucked coming and fucked going and why no one was ever going to read the fucking note anyway, so why not just shh, hissed FitzJames. Something was circling them.
Just out of sight, in the rolling, swirling fog, both men could hear heavy footsteps in the gravel and ice. Something very large was breathing. It was walking on all fours, not more than 15 feet from them in the thick fog, the sound of huge paws clearly audible over the heavy gun rumble of distant thunder.
Off! Off! Off!
Crozier could hear the exhalations with each heavy footfall. It was behind them now, circling the cairn, circling them. Both men got to their feet. Crozier fumbled his pistol out. He pulled off his mitten and cocked the weapon as the footsteps and breathing stopped directly ahead of them, but still out of sight in the fog. Crozier was certain he could smell its fish and carrion breath. FitzJames, who was still holding the inkpot and pen Crozier had given back to him and who had no pistol with him, pointed at the fog to where he thought the thing waited. Gravel crunched as the thing moved stealthily toward them. Slowly, a triangular head materialized in the fog, 5 feet above the ground. Wet white fur blended with the mist. Inhuman black eyes studied them from only 6 feet away. Crozier aimed the pistol at a point just above that head. His hand was so firm and steady that he did not even have to hold his breath. The head moved closer, floating as if it were unattached to any body. Then the giant shoulders came into view. Crozier fired, making sure to shoot high so as not to strike that face. The report was deafening, especially to nervous systems set on edge by scurvy. The white bear, little more than a cub, let out a startled woof, reared back, wheeled, and ran off on all fours, disappearing into the fog in seconds. The scrabbling, running paw steps on gravel were audible for a long minute after, heading toward the ice sea to the northwest. Crozier and FitzJames started laughing then. Neither man could stop.
every time one of them would slow in the laughter, the other would begin, and then both would be caught up again in the mad, senseless hilarity. They clutched their own sides from the pain of the laughter against their bruised ribs. Crozier dropped the pistol, and both men started laughing harder. They clapped each other's backs, pointed toward the fog, and laughed until the tears froze on their cheeks and whiskers. They clutched each other for support while they laughed harder. Both captains collapsed on the gravel and leaned back against the cairn, that action alone causing the laughter to return in force. Eventually, the guffaws turned to giggles, and the giggles into embarrassed snorts, the snorts into a few final laughs, and finally those died into a mutual gasping for air.
"You know what I would give my left bollock for right now?"
asked Captain Francis Crozier.
"What?"
"A glass of whiskey. 2 glasses, I mean. One for me and one for you. The drinks would be on me, James. I'm standing you 2 around.
Fitzjames nodded, wiping ice from his eyelids and picking frozen snot from his reddish moustache and beard.
"Thank you, Francis. And I'd lift the first toast to you. I've never had the honour of serving under a better commander or a finer man."
"Could I please have the inkpot and pen back?" said Crozier.
Pulling his mitten back on, he fumbled the stones out, found the canister, opened it, spread the sheet of paper out upside down on his knee, tugged his mitten off again, cracked the ice in the inkpot with the pen, and in the tiny space remaining under his signature, wrote,
"And start tomorrow, 26th, for Back's Fish River."
Chapter 44. Good Sir. Latitude 69 degrees, ? North. Longitude 98 degrees, ? West. Comfort Cove, 6 June, 1848. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir.
Tuesday, 6 June. Captain Fitzjames has finally died. It is a blessing. Unlike the others who have died in the last 6 weeks since we first started hauling the boat south, a living hell of a vocation from which even the ship's only surviving surgeon is not exempted, the captain, in my opinion, did not perish from the scurvy. He had scurvy, there is no doubt of that. I just completed the post-mortem examination of that good man, and the bruises and bleeding gums and blackened lips all told the story, but I think scurvy was not the killer. Captain Fitzjames's last 3 days were spent here, about 80 miles south of Terror Camp, on a frozen point on a windswept bay, where the bulk of King William Land curves sharply to the west. For the first time in 6 weeks, we have unpacked all the tents, including the large ones, and used some coal from the few sacks we brought along, and the iron whaleboat stove one crew has manhauled so far. Almost all of our meals the past 6 weeks have been eaten cold or only partially heated over the tiny spirit stoves. For the last 2 nights, we have had hot food. Never enough. 1/3 of the rations we need for the incredibly strenuous work we are doing, but warm, nonetheless. For 2 mornings, we have wakened in the same place. The men are calling this place Comfort Cove. Mostly we stopped to allow Captain Fitzjames to die in peace. But there was no peace for the captain in his last days. Poor Lieutenant Le Vicomte had evidenced some of the same symptoms of Captain Fitzjames's last days. Lieutenant Le Vicomte died suddenly on our 13th day on this terrible voyage south, only 18 miles from Terror Camp, if I remember correctly, and on the same day that Marine Private Pilkington expired. But the symptoms of scurvy had been more advanced in both the lieutenant and the private, and their final agonies less excruciatingly drawn out. I confess that I hadn't remembered that Lieutenant Le Vicomte's first name had been Harry. Our intercourse had always been quite friendly, but also quite formal, and on the muster rolls I recalled his name had been listed as H.T.D. Le Vicomte. It bothers me now that I must have heard the other officers call him Harry from time to time, perhaps 100 times, but I had always been too busy or preoccupied to notice. It was only after Lieutenant Le Vicomte's death that I paid attention to the other men using his Christian name. Private Pilkington's Christian name was William, I remember that day in early May, after Le Vicomte's and Private Pilkington's brief joint burial service. One of the men suggested that we name the small spur of land where they were buried Le Vicomte Point, but Captain Crozier vetoed that idea, saying that if we named every place where one of us might end up buried after the dead person there, we'd run out of land before we ran out of names. This befuddled the men, and I confess that it befuddled me as well. It must have been an attempt at humour, but it shocked me. It shocked the men into silence as well. Perhaps that was Captain Crozier's purpose. It did put a stop to the men offering to name natural features after their dead officers. Captain Fitzjames had shown a general weakening for some weeks, even before we left Terror Camp, but 4 days ago he seemed to have been struck down by something more sudden in its attack and far more agonizing in its effects. The captain had been suffering problems with his stomach and bowels for some weeks, but suddenly on the 2nd of June, Fitzjames collapsed. Our protocol on the march is not to stop for sick men, but rather to place them in one of the larger boats and pull them along with the other supplies and dead weight. Captain Crozier made sure that Captain Fitzjames was made as comfortable as possible in his own whaleboat. Since we are doing this long march south in relays, working for hours on end to pull 5 of the 10 heavy boats as little as a few hundred yards across the terrible gravel and snow, always trying to stay on the land when possible, rather than be forced to deal with pack ice and pressure ridges, sometimes covering less than a mile in a day on the resisting gravel and ice, I make it my practice to stay with the sickest men while the man-hauling teams go back for the other 5 boats. Often Mr. Diggle and Mr. Wall gamely preparing to cook warmer meals for almost 100 starving men on their little spirit stoves, and a few men with muskets to guard against the thing on the ice, or Eskimo, are my only companions for those hours, other than the sick and dying. Captain Fitzjames's nausea, vomiting and diarrhea were terrible, unrelenting. The cramps curled him into a fetal position and made this strong and brave man cry aloud. On the 2nd day, he tried to rejoin his team man-hauling his whaleboat. Even the officers pull from time to time, but soon he collapsed yet again. This time the vomiting and cramps were non-stop. When the whaleboat was left on the ice that afternoon, as the able-bodied men went back to man-haul forward the 5 boats left behind on the first haul, Captain Fitzjames confessed to me that his vision was terribly blurred and that he was frequently seeing double. I asked him if he had been wearing the wire goggles we used to block the sun. The men hate them because they obscure vision so terribly, and the goggles tend to induce their own headaches. Captain Fitzjames admitted that he had not been wearing them, but pointed out that the day had been quite cloudy. None of the other men were wearing them either. At that point, our conversation stopped, as he was seized with diarrhea and vomiting yet again. Late that night in the Holland tent, where I was attending him, Fitzjames gasped to me that he was having trouble swallowing, and that his mouth was constantly dry. Soon he showed trouble breathing, and was no longer able to speak. By sunrise, a paralysis had moved down his upper arms to the point where he could no longer lift them or use his hands to write messages to me. Captain Crozier called a halt that day, the first such full day's stop we had enjoyed since leaving Terror Camp almost 6 weeks earlier. All of the tents were pitched. The larger sick bay tent was finally unpacked from Crozier's own whaleboat. It took almost 3 hours to set it up in the wind and cold, and the men are much more sluggish about such things these days. And for the first time in almost a month and a half, all the sick were made comfortable in one place. Mr. Hoare, Captain Fitzjames's long-suffering steward, had died on the 2nd day of our march. We had made less than a mile that first terrible day of man-hauling, and the stack of coal stoves and other goods was still horribly but plainly visible behind us at Terror Camp that first night. It was as if we had achieved nothing after 12 hours of deadly labour. Those first days it took us 7 days to cross the narrow, iced inlet south of Terror Camp and travel only 6 miles, almost destroyed our morale and will to go on. Marine Private Heather, who had lost a portion of his brain months before, finally allowed his body to die on our 4th day out. His surviving fellow Marines played a bagpipe over his shallow, hastily dug grave that evening. And so it went with the other sick, dying rapidly. But then there came a long period after the twin deaths of Lieutenant Le Vicomte and Private Pilkington at the end of the 2nd week, in which no one died.
The men convinced themselves that the truly ill had died off and only the strong remained. Captain Fitzjames's sudden collapse reminded us that we were all growing weaker. There were no longer any truly strong among us, except perhaps for the giant Magnus Manson, who lumbers along imperturbably and who never seems to lose weight or energy. To treat Captain Fitzjames's constant vomiting, I administered doses of asafoetida, a gum resin used to control spasms. It helped very little. He was not able to keep down either solid food or liquids. I gave him lime water to settle his stomach, but it also did no good. For his difficulty swallowing, I administered syrup of squills, a sliced herb set in tannin solution that is an excellent expectorant. Usually effective, it seemed to do little to lubricate the dying man's throat. As Captain Fitzjames lost the use and control of first his arms and then his legs, I tried Peruvian wine of coca, a powerful admixture of wine and cocaine, as well as solutions of hartshorn, a medicine made from ground-up antlers of red deer, which stinks strongly of ammonia, as well as solution of camphor. These solutions at half the dosage I gave to the captain often arrest and even reverse paralysis. They did not help. The paralysis spread to all of Captain Fitzjames's extremities. He continued vomiting and being doubled up by cramps long after he could no longer speak or gesture. But at least this deadening of his vocal apparatus relieved the men of the burden of hearing their Erebus captain scream in pain. But I saw his convulsions and his mouth open in silent screams that long last day. This morning, on the fourth and final day of Captain Fitzjames's agony, his lungs began to shut down as the paralysis reached his respiratory muscles. He labored all day to breathe. Lloyd and I, sometimes abetted by Captain Crozier, who spent many hours with his friend at the end, would set Fitzjames in a sitting position, or hold him upright, or actually walk the paralyzed man around the tent, dragging his limp, stockinged feet across the ice and gravel floor in a vain attempt to help his failing lungs continue to work. In desperation, I forced tincture of lobelia, a whiskey-colored solution of Indian tobacco that was almost pure nicotine, down Captain Fitzjames's throat, massaging it down his paralyzed gullet with my bare fingers. It was like feeding a dying baby bird. Tincture of lobelia was the best respiratory stimulant left in my depleted surgeon's apothecary, a stimulant that Dr. Peddy had sworn by. "It would raise Jesus from the dead a day early," Peddy used to blaspheme when in his cups. It did no good whatsoever. It must be remembered that I am a mere surgeon, not a physician. My training was in anatomy. My expertise is in surgery. Physicians prescribe, surgeons saw. But I am doing my best with the supplies my dead colleagues left to me. The most terrible thing about Captain James Fitzjames's last hours was that he was fully alert through all of this. The vomiting and cramps, the loss of his voice and ability to swallow, the creeping paralysis, and the final terrible hours of his lungs failing. I could see the panic and terror in his eyes. His mind was fully alive. His body was dying around him. He could do nothing about this living torture except to plead with me through his eyes. I was impotent to help. At times I wanted to administer a lethal dose of pure coca just to put an end to his suffering, but my Hippocratic oath and Christian belief did not allow that. I went outside and wept instead, making sure that none of the officers or men could see me. Captain Fitzjames died at 8 minutes after 3 p.m. this afternoon, Tuesday, the 6th day of June, in the year of our Lord, 1848. His shallow grave had already been dug. The covering rocks had been gathered and stacked. All of the men who could stand and dress themselves turned out for the service. Many of those who had served under Captain Fitzjames the past 3 years wept. Even though it was warm today, 5 to 10 degrees above freezing, a cold wind came up out of the relentless northwest and froze many tears to beards, or cheeks, or comforters. The few marines left in our expedition fired a volley into the air. Up the hill from the grave, a ptarmigan took to the air and flew out toward the pack ice. A great moan went up from the men, not for Captain Fitzjames, but for the loss of the ptarmigan for the evening's stew. By the time the marines reloaded their muskets, the bird was 100 yards away and far out of range.
And none of these marines ever could have hit a bird on the wing at 100 yards, even when they were well and warm. Later, just a half hour ago, Captain Crozier looked in on the sickbay tent and beckoned me outside into the cold. "Was it scurvy that killed Captain Fitzjames?" was his only question to me. I admitted that I did not think it was. It had been something more deadly. Captain Fitzjames thought that the steward serving him and the other officers since Hoare's death was poisoning him, whispered the captain. Is this possible? Bridgens, I said too loudly. I was deeply shocked. I had always liked the bookish old steward. Crozier shook his head. Richard Aylmore has been serving the Erebus officers the last 2 weeks, he said. Could it have been poison, Dr. Goodsir? I hesitated. To say yes would certainly mean Aylmore would be shot at sunrise. The gunroom steward was the man who had been given 50 lashes in January for his improvident participation in the Grand Venetian Carnival. Aylmore was also a friend and frequent confidant of Terror's diminutive and sometimes devious Calker's mate. Aylmore, we all knew, harboured a small and resentful soul. It could well have been poison, I told Crozier not half an hour ago, but not necessarily a deliberately administered poison. What does that mean? Demanded Crozier. Our remaining captain looked so weary tonight that his white skin actually glowed in the starlight. I said, I mean that the officers have been eating the largest portions of the last of the Goldner's canned foods that we have brought along. There sometimes is an unexplained but deadly paralytic poison in foods that have gone bad. No one understands it. Perhaps it is some microscopic animalcule we cannot perceive with our lenses. Crozier whispered, wouldn't we have smelled it if the canned foods had gone putrid? I shook my head and grasped the captain's greatcoat sleeve to press home my point. No, that is the terror of this poison that paralyzes first the voice and then the entire body. It cannot be seen or tested for. It is as invisible as death itself. Crozier thought for a long moment. I'll order everyone to go off the canned food for 3 weeks, he said at last. The last of the rotten salted beef and poor biscuits will have to do us for a while. We'll eat it cold. The men and officers will not be happy about this, I whispered. The canned soups and vegetables are as close as anything comes to a hot meal on the march. They may become mutinous at such further deprivation under such harsh conditions. Crozier smiled then. It was a strangely chilling sight. Then I will not have everyone go off the canned foods, he hissed. Gunroom steward Aylmore will continue eating it out of the same cans he served James Fitzjames from. A good night to you, Dr. Goodsir. I came back into the sickbay tent then, attended to the sleeping sick men, and crawled into my sleeping bag with my mahogany portable writing desk on my knees. My handwriting is so difficult to read on the page because I have been shaking, and not just from the cold. Every time I believe I know one of these men or officers, I find that I am wrong. A million years of man's medicinal progress will never reveal the secret condition and sealed compartments of the human soul. We leave before dawn tomorrow. I suspect there will be no more stops, such as the luxury of the last 2 days at Comfort Cove.